UK Nurses at the Center of Healthcare, an online gene center for nursing education, and the incredible cost of foodborne illnesses. Plus, we're going to take a look at foodborne illness. If that's what you're looking for, you found it. It's The Nursing Show. Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to this week's episode. We have a lot coming up and always action-packed episode, at least in our short little half-hour bits of time we spend together each week. And I just wanted to remind all of you very briefly to head on over and check out all of the links to everything talked about in today's show over at nursingshow.com. You'll find a link there right in the top of the page for show notes. You can also check down on the right-hand side in one of the columns there, you'll see links to recent articles and posts, and you can find recent things put up there in The Nursing Show as well. And of course, you also have an updates tab in the top that you can look for recent updates and articles. All of that available at nursingshow.com. You can also subscribe to our newsletter. We send out information for our show notes every week. Also, occasional updates and information that you might be interested in, different things we have available here at The Nursing Show that come out a couple times a month. And all of that's available if you're a subscriber to The Nursing Show newsletter, and you'll find that sign up over at nursingshow.com. Of course, if you'd like to get back in touch with me directly by email, you can do that. Send those emails in to nursingshow@gmail.com, nursingshow@gmail.com, and I will get back to you right away. Got a couple of good emails in this week from listeners, and one of them in particular caught my eye. Listener Eric checked in. He is a pre-nursing student right now, trying to get into nursing school and really trying to find a way to overcome some challenges from his past. Now, he has a few misdemeanor convictions on his record, and he was checking in to see if there was anything I knew about how nursing boards dealt with that, employers, and things like that. And, you know, the problem is every nursing board's different. Every employer is different, and certainly you're going to have a good explanation on how things have changed between now and then and what you've done differently. And based on some of the things you talked about, which I won't go into here because they're a little too specific, but I think that, Eric, based on what you've told me, you seem to have turned a page in your life. And if that's indeed the case, you just might have to put a little bit of mileage behind you and pay some dues and show that you can stay on the straight and narrow and keep things ready to go before you have to move forward in your nursing career. But I applaud you for wanting to help out and give back to people. If you'd like to comment like Eric did, go ahead and send those emails in, nursingshow@gmail.com. I respond back to every email I get, so even if I don't read it or refer to it here on the show, I will send you a response back. I try to make sure I get in touch with all of my listeners. When you take the time to touch base with me, I want to make sure I send a message back. Let's jump on into this week's news, and I'll lead off with a story I picked up over at medicalnewstoday.com. This particular story, an article coming from the UK, and it's looking at a recent report from the Prime Minister's Commission. This report is solidly putting nurses and midwives in the center of the UK's National Health Service, getting rid of some of the old ideas and making nurses the highly respected professionals in terms of the entire organization of the health service, as they are, I think, viewed by many members of society. This is an article that was put out by Unison. This is the head of a public sector union in the UK. And one of the head of that union, Gail Adams, said this report, quote, makes clear the central role nurses and midwives play in ensuring patients receive high quality, compassionate care. And I think none of us can disagree with that assessment. No matter where you are a nurse, I think we all work hard to be central to the act of providing that type type of high quality and compassionate care to our patients in whatever role we play in the healthcare in our patients' lives, whether you're a nurse in a doctor's office, whether you're working in a medical facility, urgent care center, hospital, whatever the case may be, even a public health nurse, or somebody who's working in the commercial sector, perhaps as a nurse in a manufacturing system or an office nurse working for a major corporation, all of us really work towards improving the health of our patients overall, whoever that patient population might be. So it's exciting to see this. I enjoy and really am looking forward to more countries moving nursing to the center of the healthcare debate. I think we've seen some of that here in the United States, but I'd still like to see more steps in the U.S. towards what other countries are doing. Australia has a chief nurse that reports to the prime minister directly as a member of the cabinet. And I think that something like that is important here too, because the Surgeon General has a point of view, many physicians have, but I think a nurse brings a different point of view to that table, and I'd like to see something like that here in the United States. Next up in the news, an exciting step for online resources for education of new nurses and, according to this article, also physician assistants and doctors. This is a new online tool being made available for educators, launched by the National Human Genome Research Institute, part of the National Institutes of Health. Now, this article also came from medicalnewstoday.com, and this article is talking about a new research, online research tool that will be opened up to add information and provide resources and research information to nursing students, medical students, physician assistant students, people in all levels of healthcare. And it's part of the National Institutes of Health and the National Human Genome Research Institute's effort to move forward in giving healthcare professionals better knowledge and information about genetics and genomics and other information regarding gene research, gene therapies, and the advent of what is probably going to be a major change and shift in the way we deal with a lot of diseases. Once we have mapped the genome, we can move forward to help people overcome parts of their gene code that give them a certain predisposition towards certain illnesses. Yeah, there's been a lot of fear associated with this, saying, oh, well, if I know you're predisposed to get cancer, then maybe you're not a good risk for my corporate benefits plan. But of course, the other side of that from the healthcare perspective is if we recognize that early on, we can use that information to provide better care, to reduce other risk factors, and hopefully eventually make an adjustment in that gene to help the person overcome that risk factor directly. And I think that's the ultimate goal here, is to work towards that. So this information will be made available. Check the link in the show notes to find out more about this and follow up on it. Find out how you can get access to it, either as an educator, student, or a working nurse, and what you need to do to work towards getting access. So I think this is an exciting step in the right direction to providing more information so that we can do better research as nurses in the areas that are important to us. Finally, an article that caught my eye from Reuters.com, and it's actually a report not on something in the UK, but on something here in the US, looking at the incredible cost of foodborne illnesses here in the United States. This particular article citing that the United States pays $152 billion, that's billion with a B, folks, billion dollars a year in expenses covering foodborne illnesses, and that this is a lot more than other estimates had previously released, that it's really widespread and maybe one of the more underreported illnesses because it's self-limiting in many cases, because people don't always associate what they have going on with a foodborne problem. They might associate it with just a general bug. And so they end up not reporting this or seeking medical care. And this does incur cost in lost wages and direct healthcare costs and all kinds of things. So I find this interesting. Lots of unknown pathogens coming into the food supply as new pathogens every year. And this is one of the things that kind of made me look up and start doing some research and pointed me towards what I was going to do for this week's tip and trick of the week. So we'll move on to that in just a bit. Time for this week's tip of the week, and as I said earlier in the news, we're going to be talking a little bit more in-depth about foodborne illnesses. Let's talk a little bit about what we're going to cover. We're going to be looking at a couple of different things. We'll be looking at the health impact of foodborne illnesses, some of the numbers associated, and morbidity and mortality. We'll also be looking at some of the most commonly encountered foodborne illnesses, diagnosis of foodborne illnesses, and management of foodborne illnesses. We're also going to touch briefly on food safety education, some resources you can use to teach food safety to your patients, and just general nursing considerations to keep in mind when dealing with patients that might have a suspected foodborne illness. Let's talk about the impact of foodborne illnesses on us. I heard that news story I covered earlier in this episode, and in that episode, they were talking about the impact being widespread and $152 billion cost to the United States every year. In fact, according to the Centers for Disease Control, there are 76 million cases of foodborne illnesses every year, resulting in about 5,000 deaths. So they aren't all very serious, but 5,000 deaths that might be prevented or 5,000 deaths too many. Worldwide, just to give you an idea of the scope beyond the developed world, especially in third world countries, worldwide diarrheal illnesses kill 2 million children every single year, a huge number associated with something that can be really resolved if somebody has access to some basic fluid rehydration therapy. And this could be no more than just some clean water, some sugar, and some salt to replenish and refuel the child while they're dealing with a diarrheal illness. More than 250 different types of pathogens, of microorganisms and other toxins cause these foodborne illnesses. There's so many of them, and there are new ones that are being seen every day as they encounter new ways of handling food products, as new food products are begun to be developed in new areas of the world. These new areas have unique pathogens associated with those areas in the soil, and they may be transferred to food, and if improperly handled, can cause problems down the road. Some of the more common illnesses, though, are, first of all, they're basic categories: bacterial infections, viral infections, and then other types of infections from toxins. Bacterial infections, the most common, Campylobacter, Salmonella, and E. coli. We recognize those names because those are really the ones that we hear in the news: Salmonella outbreaks, E. coli problems. We see these types of things come up when we talk about widespread foodborne illnesses in manufactured and processed foods shipped around the country. Also, viral infections that we see, Calici virus, which is also known as the Norwalk viruses, and viruses that are like the Norwalk virus. These are commonly spread from direct food handling from food workers that have not washed their hands. They are infected with the Norwalk virus, and they pass it on through touching the food. And this is other things. Now, other things that we talk about as foodborne illnesses could be things on the food, toxins from the soil, also side effects related to unwashed fruits and vegetables, raw foods that have some kind of toxic buildup in them, such as heavy metal buildup, pesticides, things like that. So we need to really have a better handle on where our food's coming from because of other ways that foodborne illness can strike us. There are a lot of signs and symptoms. So when we talk about assessing and diagnosing foodborne illnesses, there's a lot of different things to look at. But it's important to understand that usually, because it's ingested, we're going to see GI symptoms first. And so we would be looking for nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, abdominal pain. And then we may look for signs of that of blood in the diarrhea. Also, be prepared for taking a fecal culture, stool sample, because that's going to be one way to diagnose this. We'll talk about that in a little bit. We should maintain, according to the Centers for Disease Control, and there's an excellent resource I've linked to show you over there, we should maintain a high index of suspicion with regard to dealing with any patient that might have a foodborne illness. Why? Well, according to the CDC, we never know when we have that index case, that first patient that got a foodborne illness and is ill and is going to spread it to everybody they know if we don't get a handle on it. So we need to find out, or that index person is the first case of a foodborne illness that's going to spread via a restaurant or a commonly used type of food that's been shipped around, fruits and vegetables, lettuce. We talked about a lot of things in the news over the last year or two. There are many things. So maintain a high index of suspicion for anybody with GI symptoms that they may have a foodborne illness. And how do you find that out? Well, you need to do some really good investigative work. You need to be a detective and get good history on the patient, including asking questions about where have they eaten recently? Have they eaten anything unusual or different? Did they eat partially cooked or uncooked food? And where was that? This may be something that you need to kind of work up some kind of a history-taking tool where we go back and find out what their meals were for the last 48 hours, where they ate and what they ate and everything they ate, and then start looking in that list for some things that raise red flags, whether it's raw foods, fresh fruits and vegetables included in that. Also, uncooked foods or partially cooked foods, you know, hamburgers. People love those hamburgers, medium rare, but if they're still pink inside, they're probably not cooked to a safe temperature to kill E. coli. So when that happens, if you take that chance, you might end up catching something. And if that's something that you bought at the grocery store, maybe all of the ground beef at the grocery store is got E. coli in it, and everybody that fails to cook it enough is going to succumb. So we need to keep an eye on that. Understand that the illness may resolve, in fact, likely will resolve before the cause is identified. A lot of these illnesses, our bodies are very good at fighting off. We just get sick for a couple of days. In a healthy individual with a healthy immune system, staying hydrated, sitting it out, so to speak, and we will eventually feel better. And we may not even seek medical attention. And so a lot of foodborne illnesses are probably not reported. Again, remember, we will be getting stool samples. Bacterial food borne illnesses are identified because we culture them and identify them in the microscope. Parasitic infestations also identified by microscope. Viral illnesses are related to something so small that can't be easily identified with a light microscope. So we will be looking for protein markers on DNA markers for the viruses that would be easy to find in the stool samples, and they're developing better ways to do that all the time. But keep in mind that that stool sample is going to be necessary if you suspect a foodborne illness. Management of foodborne illnesses, well, again, many of them are going to be self-limiting. The patients just need to do general palliative care for themselves. Rest, relax, get plenty of fluids, try not to get dehydrated, and eventually work their way out of it. And if it lasts for too long, we may need to move into some more definitive care. But again, treat your symptoms. They may be febrile, so they're going to need some kind of antipyretic medication, and they're going to need fluid replacement. So talk to them about drinking fluids, trying to flush this out of their system. I tend to think when I educate patients, if I can give them some visual image, you know, that, hey, if you drink this water, you're going to help move things through a little bit faster. And they don't seem to get the idea. They think if they're putting more fluid in, it's just going to make the diarrhea worse. And we need to educate them that that's not the case, that the fluid actually needs to be put in to replace the fluid they're losing because of the diarrhea, and also to help their body absorb it so they can be healthy faster. Antimicrobial therapy may be needed in patients who have illnesses that have immune compromise or other problems, the very old, the very young. And if they have had an illness for a certain length of time, 3 or 4 days, it doesn't seem to be getting better, they come in and seek attention, these patients may get some kind of antimicrobial therapy. And this will be specific to the cultured organism. So some kind of broad antibiotic in the beginning until they can identify what specific organism it is, and then they'll target in with a specific targeted antibiotic after the fact. Remember that we need to report suspected foodborne illnesses to the health department, because this can be a broad, widespread problem. And again, we don't want anybody to die with something that could be easily prevented. Just a quick touch on food safety education. And to find out more, I urge you to head over and check out foodsafety.gov. How easy is that? Basically, there are 4 things that people need to learn to do and to keep an eye on. They need to learn to clean, separate, cook, and properly chill foods. Now, this is pretty easy, but basically, just like we talk about all the time, you got to wash those dirty hands. You got to definitely wash your hands before handling food, during handling food, and after handling food. Also, wash surfaces very often. Separate the food to prevent cross-contamination. If you're going to be handling raw food to cut it up into smaller pieces for cooking or for whatever the recipe calls for, you need to not use the same cutting surface or cutting device to cut up your cooked food after it's prepared. Also, make sure we're cooking food to the proper temperatures. There's a temperature guide available at foodsafety.gov, so check that out. And a lot of good information there, handouts, things you can download. You can get posters from them. I mean, they've got a ton of resources. Very colorful, very interesting site to utilize as an educator, and I really am excited to see that. Also, make sure, finally, that you chill unused food quickly and get it down to minus 40 degrees, not negative 40 degrees, but below 40 degrees Fahrenheit in your refrigerator. And people who have a refrigerator at home should have some kind of a thermometer in there to make sure the refrigerator actually is keeping food below 40 degrees Fahrenheit. Commercial refrigerators are supposed to have a temperature thermometer in there so that they can constantly monitor it, but most of us don't have one in our fridge at home, so it might be a good idea to spend a few bucks, get yourself a thermometer to hang in your refrigerator or put in your refrigerator so that you can see what the temperature is in there when you open it up to get out a bottle of wine after a long day at work. Because wine's supposed to be chilled to a certain temperature, right? Anyway, that's a little bit on food safety. Quick nursing considerations. Protect yourself and other patients by making sure you're taking appropriate precautions. You need to wash your hands before you go in and see all your patients. If you have a patient that has a suspected foodborne illness, you need to make sure you're washing your hands carefully afterwards. If a patient is on some kind of isolation, observe the isolation practices. Don't just assume that if you walk in and out very quickly to do something, that it ain't going to stick to you. Because I've seen it happen. Take the extra few seconds to put on the gown, the gloves, the mask, whatever is required to treat these patients so that you're not carrying things to other patients or taking it home with you to infect yourself and your family. Remember that a lot of these things are self-limiting, so we don't necessarily need to see all these patients. You know, I know somebody wants to get that payment for bringing them into the office, but we can also probably treat a lot of these patients at home through telenursing and care through that route. And let's make sure we're talking about that and bringing that to the forefront as a way to control healthcare costs. Remember our at-risk populations, anybody is immune compromised, infants and young children, and the very old, as the people get older or the very young, they have less physiologic reserve in their system. They don't maintain as much fluid reserve, and so it's very easy for them to become quickly dehydrated and become decompensated and head towards a shock simply because of an ongoing infection that if a little bit of fluid was administered, they could possibly hold on a little bit better. But we need to remember that these risk populations are unable to care for themselves very well, so we need to make sure that we're keeping an eye out for them. And make sure you understand the reporting requirements for your region, for your health department, so that if something does need to be reported, it gets reported to the right place so that the resources that are available can be brought to hand to try to get a handle on an outbreak of foodborne illness in your area. I've got some excellent references for you over at the Nursing Show site in the show notes for this episode to all of the things talked about in this tip. And I urge you to follow up on them. Some great resources available for you and for your patients in those links. So you'll want to follow up on them. Again, head to nursingshow.com. And right there at the top is your show notes link. And that'll bring up the most recent episode. You can scroll down and look at past episodes as well. And click on those links and head over and check out each show notes page. And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I want to remind all of you that you can find a lot more information, including links to everything discussed in this and every other episode, over at nursingshow.com. You'll find links to the show notes right there at the top of the page under the show notes link. You can also look back and check out all of the great articles and other information you'll find available at nursingshow.com. If you want to comment on this episode or any other episode, you can, of course, comment on any article at the Nursing Show site. There's a comments link. You can also send us email in. Our new email address is nursingshow@gmail.com, nursingshow@gmail.com. Catch us by email. Send us in your tips, suggestions, links to news items, and yes, corrections, because we want to make sure we have the best possible information here available for you on the Nursing Show. Don't forget, you can also find me on Twitter and Facebook under the handle PodMedic, and you can also find and become a fan of the Nursing Show fan page. You'll get updates, information, and usually early access to the Nursing Show. When I record it, I post the links up there earlier in the week. That's going to do it for me. Let's wrap up the show with some PodSafe music, and I'll close out the show with something new again this week. This is a PodSafe independent artist, Adrena Thorpe, with her music, Everything Changes, this particular song. If you like what you hear, check out her music. There's also a link in the show notes to pick up this song and others of Adrena's songs over at iTunes. The link will take you directly into iTunes. You can take a look at it there. And then if you like what you hear, definitely spend a little money and purchase the music that these artists make available here on podcasts like The Nursing Show. I'm Jamie Davis, the PodMedic. I'll be back again next Friday with another episode here of The Nursing Show. And in the meantime, please remember to stay safe and stay tuned here to The Nursing Show. Take care. Because I've heard
it